2. The voyage to Le Havre proved uneventful. Smooth but foggy much of the time was about all Wilbur had to say of the crossing. He reached Paris on May 29, and for the next week he and Hart Berg were on the move, touring possible sites for the public demonstrations, including Fontainebleau and Vitry, but found nothing suitable. The French press, aware of Wilbur's return, had a tendency to be hostile, he reported to Orville, but to almost anyone else it would have seemed considerably more than a tendency. The popular L'Illustration, as an example, ran a heavily retouched photograph of the flyer taken at Kitty Hawk, saying its appearance seems quite dubious, and one finds in it every element of a fabrication, not especially well done, moreover. Further, there was a resurgence of popular enthusiasm over French aviators and their daring feats. Earlier in the year, Henri Farman had flown for nearly 2 minutes, and that spring at the end of May, Farman made news when he took a passenger up for a ride. As Wilbur reported to Orville, Farman and Delagrange were also putting on demonstrations elsewhere in Europe, and with much success. As for themselves, Wilbur wrote, the first thing is to get some practice and make some demonstrations. Then let the future be what it may. Hart Berg assured a correspondent for Lotto that within 2 months the Wright plane would fly before the people. The period of secret trials was over, Berg said. The French public would be the first to see with their own eyes. But where? On June 8, he and Wilbur went by train to Le Mans, a quiet, ancient town of some 65,000 people, on the Sarthe River in the department of the Sarthe, 125 miles southwest of Paris. A prominent automobile manufacturer, ballooning enthusiast, and leading local citizen named Léon Bollée, hearing of Wilbur's need for a suitable field, had sent a message to Berg suggesting Le Mans, where there was plenty of flat, open space. Bollée met Wilbur and Berg at the station in one of the largest and handsomest of his automobile line and took them off on a tour. As it turned out, no one could have been more genial or helpful or generous with his time than Léon Bollée. Short and dark-bearded, he was extremely fat, weighing 240 pounds. The physical contrast with Wilbur was more pronounced even than between Wilbur and Hart Berg. Like Wilbur, Bollée had not attended a university, but instead joined his father's bell foundry business and eventually began building automobiles with much success. Léon Bollée automobiles are constructed using only top-quality materials in the vast and beautiful factories of Le Mans, read a recent advertisement. His English was reasonably good, and Wilbur liked him at once. As things turned out, Bollée would do more to help Wilbur than anyone, and never asked for anything in return. Of possible sites, the Unandier horse race track, about 5 miles out from town, seemed to Wilbur most suitable. The course was entirely enclosed by trees, and the ground was rough. Still, he would report to Orville, he thought it would serve their purpose. Bollée said he would see what could be arranged. He also offered Wilbur full use of a large room at his factory in which to assemble the flyer, in addition to the help of some of his workers. 3 days later, back in Paris, Wilbur received word from Bollée that the Unandier racetrack was available, and the day after Wilbur was busy getting ready, buying overalls, work shoes, and a straw hat. One evening in the elegant Louis XVI salon of Berg's apartment, Wilbur sat for an interview with a young French aviation journalist, François Perret, who knew it was the first interview Wilbur had agreed to do in France. Berg had made the arrangements. They talked of the experiments at Kitty Hawk, of motors and patents, and why Le Mans had been the choice for the demonstrations. But it was Wilbur himself, about whom Perret had had his doubts, who became the subject of greatest fascination. Mr. Hart O. Berg warmed up for the interview by offering me a cup of coffee and laid out a box of cigars, Peyret would write. I felt my doubts fly away one by one in the blue smoke. Through curls of smoke I examined Wilbur Wright, his thin, serious face, lit by the strangely gentle, intelligent, and radiant eyes. I had to admit, no, this man is not a bluffer. The interview marked an important beginning. In the months to come, François Peyret was to provide some of the most insightful, first-hand observations about Wilbur ever published. Wilbur arrived back in Le Mans close to midnight, June 16, and settled in at the Hôtel du Dauphin, in a room overlooking the main square, the Place de la République. Eager to get started on the reassembly of the flyer, he began opening the crates at the Bolle factory first thing the following day, and could hardly believe what he saw. At Kitty Hawk 2 months before, he had found the old camp a shambles. Now he was looking at the flyer in shambles, and could barely control his fury. A dozen or more ribs were broken, one wing ruined, the cloth torn in countless places. Everything was a tangled mess. Radiators were smashed, propeller axles broken, coils badly turned up, essential wires, seats, nuts, and bolts all missing. In a letter written that same day, he exploded at Orville, as he rarely had, charging him with the worst example of packing he'd ever seen. I'm sure that with a scoop shovel, I could have put things in within 2 or 3 minutes and made fully as good a job of it. I never saw such evidences of idiocy. It was going to take much longer than he had figured to get everything ready to go, and there was no Orville or Charlie Taylor to help. He set immediately to work, putting things in order and making repairs. Worked all today and a few hours yesterday, replacing broken ribs in the surfaces, he recorded in his diary, June 18. Had to take one wing entirely down to fix it. Found many things not as well as in the old machine. Rear wire not inside of cloth right. Little washers on this wire not on the proper side of ribs. No blocks to hold the end ribs of sections from slipping back. No steel ferrules on front lower spar under heavy uprights. Not play enough in rear hinges joining sections. No cloth wrapping around spar where screw frames fasten on. The mechanics at the Bolle factory did as best they could to help, but were of little use at first. I've had an awful job sewing the section together, he informed Orville in another letter. I was the only one strong enough in the fingers to pull the wires together tight, so I had all the sewing to do myself. My hands were about raw when I was not half done. In putting things together, he added, I noticed many evidences that your mind was on something else while you worked last summer. But then Wilbur learned that the chaos and damage had not been caused at Dayton, but at Le Havre, by careless French customs inspectors, and he apologized to Orville at once. Orville, knowing the stress his brother was under, made no issue of the matter. Wilbur labored on steadily, installing uprights and wires, and fixing the old engine, after finding work he had had done on it by French mechanics, so bad he had to give a full day to it. I have to do practically all the work myself, as it is almost impossible to explain what I want in words to men who only one-fourth understand English. True to the right rules of life, he did not work on Sundays, but instead wrote letters or went sightseeing. He was living most comfortably at the Hôtel du Dauphin, where, according to the Motor Car Journal, one found nothing of luxe, simply plain, bountiful fare, cooked and served by the patron chef, which proved exactly to Wilbur's liking. And Le Mans, he was pleased to say, was an old-fashioned town, almost as much out of the world as Kitty Hawk. He loved the sound of the chimes, Bolle bells from the church across the square, and was happy to provide those at home with a lengthy description of the town's crowning edifice, the colossal Cathedral Saint-Julien. Set on a hill first settled by the Romans above the Sarthe River, it rose high over a thick cluster of medieval buildings and houses that constituted the oldest part of town. There was no steeple. Instead, the cathedral's singular exterior distinction was its prominent double buttresses. But beyond that was the rare combination of both the Romanesque and Gothic styles, all in one building, and best seen within. That part built in the Romanesque manner dated back nearly 900 years to the 11th century, while the larger, more spectacular segment had risen out of the 14th and 15th centuries, and it was this, so plainly in evidence, that so moved Wilbur. As he wrote to Catherine, the arches, forming the openings between the aisles and the choir, keep increasing in height, so that a person standing against the outside wall of the outer aisle can see way up to the top of the choir and take in the magnificent stained-glass windows of the clerestory. One saw not only the light and brilliant color of the ancient windows, but all the light and color that the windows threw onto the upper reaches of the arches, some 108 feet above the cathedral floor. If, at the time, he felt or reflected on any connection between the upward aspiration of this stunning human creation and his own unrelenting efforts in that direction, he made no mention. But it seems most unlikely that he would not have. Attending a Sunday service at the cathedral some days later, Wilbur found the only part he could understand or participate in was the collection. "Still, the great structure," he told Catherine, "impresses me more and more as one of the finest specimens of architecture I have seen." Meanwhile, just outside the cathedral, as he added, a farmer's market filled the public square, and, to cap it all, a traveling circus had set up camp. He wrote of the comforts of the hotel, praising the food especially. The meals were better than any he had had since coming to Europe, better in that they were both plentiful and not overly fancy. He described a lunch that included sliced tomatoes, cucumbers, roast tongue with mushrooms, lamb chops with new potatoes, some sort of cake, and almonds. He had never been so comfortable away from home, he said, implying perhaps that a place like the Maurice had been far too luxurious for comfort. No one at the hotel understood a word of his English, but all did their best to serve him well. A first encounter with alphabet soup provided opportunity for a touch of the wit he knew Catherine especially would appreciate. "I was a little astonished and disturbed the other evening when I sat down to dinner to find my soup, which was a sort of noodle soup, turning into all sorts of curious forms and even letters of the alphabet. I began to think I had the Jim Jams. On close investigation, I found that the dough had been run through forms so as to make the different letters of the alphabet and figures, too. It was like looking into the hell box of a printing office, and was all the more amusing because every mouthful of soup you take out brought up a new combination." Progress at the Bolle factory was hardly improving, however. "I have to do all the work myself as there are no drawings to show anyone how things go together, and explanations take more time than doing things myself. I have a man, but he is not a first-class mechanic. He has no invention or initiative, and his vocabulary is limited. When I say to him, 'Hand me the screwdriver,' he is liable to stand and gawk, or more often rush off as though he really understood me, and it is only after I have waited a long time and finally got it myself that I realize that he does not understand the special meaning of the word hand as I used it. Most of my time has been spent on things I should not have to do at all. So far, I have the main surfaces of the wing together and wired with new wires in a number of places. The skids are on, and the engine is mounted and adjusted, ready to run with the jump spark magneto in place. I have yet to put on the transmission and screws, propellers, which should be a small job. But I have the front rudder and framing and wiring yet to do, and also the rear rudder. Those who worked with him at the factory marveled at his meticulous craftsmanship, how he would make his own parts when needed, even a needle if necessary, and how at the sound of the factory whistle, he would start or stop working just as they did, as though he were one of them. On the evening of July 4, at about 6 o'clock, Wilbur, contrary to his usual work pattern, was still on the job. Only Leon Bollet remained on hand to keep him company. Having by then mounted the engine, Wilbur was standing close by, his sleeves rolled up, giving it a speed test, when suddenly a radiator hose broke loose and he was hit by a jet of boiling water. His bare left forearm took the worst of it, but he was scalded as well across his chest. Bollet eased him to the floor and ran for help. Fortunately, we had picric acid in the factory's pharmacy, he would report to Hartberg. So in less than a minute after the accident, he was swathed in bandages, soaked in picric acid. Bad as it was, the press, as usual, made the accident sound still worse, and for the family at home, Wilbur, as usual, made light of it, spending much of a letter written 3 days later describing how the local physician went about tending the wounds as would a horse doctor. Nonetheless, Wilbur insisted all was practically healed, the pain gone, when in fact it would be a month before he could use his left arm, and the stress he was under had been greatly compounded. Yet despite everything, by the first days of August he was seeing to the finishing touches on a machine reconstructed from the smashed and broken remains of the original, an airplane that was thus different from those he and Orville had built at home, and one he had never yet flown. Testing it, even under ideal conditions, could be highly dangerous. Besides, it had been 3 months since his last flight, and that had ended in a crash. It was nearly dark the evening of August 6 when Wilbur, Leon Bollet, and Hart Berg folded back the front framing of the flyer, set a couple of wheels under the skids, hitched the whole affair to Bollet's stately automobile, and hauled it down the road to Unandier racetrack 5 miles to the south. There it was put away in a shed, and to Wilbur's delight, the press was never the wiser. For all the hovering, all the surveillance by reporters, none had taken notice. To keep guard over the plane, Wilbur would sleep beside it that night, and the nights to follow. The shed was much like those at Kitty Hawk, except here there was a privy and an outdoor hose for bathing. In addition, a small nearby restaurant served very good meals, and at a farmhouse not more than 100 feet from the shed, he could get milk and enjoy visits with a small boy of 5 or 6 who spoke some English and had all the appearance of a truthful little chap. Neither his left arm nor the flyer was in a condition he would have liked, and a first public demonstration that failed in almost any way would be a serious setback. Reporters on the scene were becoming increasingly impatient, and to Wilbur increasingly annoying. A correspondent for the London Daily Mail, Joseph Brandreth, would write, "We voted him mule-headed, eccentric, unnecessarily surly in his manner toward us, for it was impossible to discover from such a sphinx what he intended to do or when he intended to do it." "I did not ask you to come here," Wilbur told him. "I shall go out when I'm ready. No, I shall not try and mislead you, newspaper men, but if you are not here, I shall not wait for you." When the exasperation with the press became acute, the genial Berg would appear out of the shed and tell them some amusing story that would almost always put everyone in good humor again. Bollet talked happily to reporters about Wilbur and his ways, describing how he would not let anyone touch his machine or handle so much as a piece of wire. He even refused to allow mechanics to pour oil into the engine, Bolle said. So sure was he that they don't do it in the correct way. Their nickname for him was Vieille Burette, Old Oil Can. Somehow the Daily Mail reporter, Brandreth, managed to get a peek at how the American eccentric was living. In a corner of the shed was his room. This consisted of a low packing case, from which the top had been removed. Resting on the edges of the case was a narrow truckle bed. Nailed to the side of the shed was a piece of looking glass, and close by, a camp washstand. This, together with a cabin trunk, a small petrol cooking stove, he cooks his own breakfast, and a camp stool, comprised the whole furniture. He takes his baths from a hose pipe attached to a well 60 feet away. He sleeps practically under the wings of his airplane. And early in the day he starts to work, whistling the while. 3. Saturday, August 8, the 8th day of the 8th month of the 8th year of the new century, was as fine as could be hoped for. The sky overhead was a great blue vault with not a cloud. A northwest breeze was a little gentler than Wilbur would have wished, but he was up to go. Word of the preparations at the racetrack had spread rapidly, and by the looks of the day, it seemed certain the show could now begin. Those who gathered were nearly all from Le Mans, and though not impressive in numbers, they looked appropriately festive as they began filling the little wooden grandstand, quite as if turning out for the horse races. Gentlemen sporting straw boaters and Panama hats, ladies in full summer skirts, their oversized summer hats covered by veils as further protection against the sun. Here and there in the trees encircling the track could be seen perched a number of youngsters from the town. The spirit was of a summer outing. The whole scene, as different, as far removed from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, as could be imagined. Some couples carried baskets with picnic lunches. As the hours passed, waiting for something to happen, nearly all kept on happily chattering. Here and there among the crowd could be seen several notables not from Le Mans. There were two Russian officers in uniform, and Ernest Archdeacon of the Aero Club de France, noted for his skeptical opinion of the rights, and of greatest interest to the others gathered, the celebrated French aviator hero Louis Blériot. What Blériot may have been thinking as he sat waiting is unknown, but Archdeacon was busy proclaiming his confidence that Wilbur Wright would fail, and was happy to explain to those close by in the grandstand all that was wrong with the Wright plane. Archdeacon's open scorn of the Wright brothers had been made especially clear in an Aero Club dinner in Paris in October 1907, when he declared, "The famous Wright brothers may today claim all they wish, if it is true, and I doubt it more and more, that they were the first to fly through the air, they will not have the glory before history. They would only have had to eschew these incomprehensible affectations of mystery and to carry out their experiments in broad daylight, like Saint-Dumont and Farman, and before official judges, surrounded by thousands of spectators." On hand, too, and in substantial numbers as expected, were the representatives of the press, reporters and correspondents from Paris, London, and New York, all waiting for what could well be one of the biggest stories of the time. Wilbur, who had been up early as usual, showed no sign of nervous tension or excitement. "Such quiet self-confidence was reassuring," said Hartberg afterward. One thing that, to me at least, made his appearance all the more dramatic was that he was not dressed as if about to do something daring or unusual. He, of course, had no special pilot's helmet or jacket, since no such garb yet existed, but appeared in the ordinary gray suit he usually wore, and a cap. And he had on, as he nearly always did when not in overalls, a high-starched collar. Inside the shed, he proceeded to work on preparations, checking everything with total concentration. As would be said by one observer from the press, neither the impatience of waiting crowds, nor the sneers of rivals, nor the pressure of financial conditions not always easy, could induce him to hurry over any difficulty before he had done everything in his power to understand and overcome it. For the spectators, the only sign of what might be about to take place were the launching track and the tall four-legged catapult set in place at the center of the field, the track placed at right angles to the grandstand, pointing directly at the trees at the opposite end of the field. At about noon, Hartberg walked out onto the field to announce over a loudspeaker that no photographs would be permitted. After much show of despair, the press photographers who had been waiting day and night held a brief meeting, after which they gave their word that if Mr. Wright agreed to allow photographs on Monday, they would take none until then. To be sure that no photographs were taken by amateurs, one press photographer would patrol the field on a bicycle. It was nearly 3 p.m. by the time Wilbur opened the shed doors and the gleaming white flyer was rolled into the sunshine, where he continued to fuss with it. He then walked the full length and width of the field, made sure the starting rail was headed exactly into the wind, checked the catapult to see if all was in order, and supervised the raising of the iron weight, never hurrying in the least. With Berg, Bollet, and several others helping, the aircraft, mounted temporarily on 2 sets of wheels, was gently rolled to the middle of the field and positioned on the starting rail. Finally, at 6:30, with dusk settling, Wilbur turned his cap backward, and to Berg, Bollet, and the others said quietly, "Gentlemen, I am going to fly." He took the seat on the left. 2 men started the engine, each pulling down a blade on the 2 propellers. Not satisfied with something he heard as the motor was warmed up, Wilbur called to a mechanic who was standing at the back of the machine to ask if some small last-minute adjustment had been made on the motor. The man said it had. According to an eyewitness, Wilbur sat silent for a moment, then slowly leaving his pilot's seat, he walked around the machine just to make sure with his own eyes that this particular adjustment had, without the slightest shadow of a doubt, been well and truly made. Back again in his seat, Wilbur released the trigger, the weight dropped, and down the rail and into the air he swept. Cheers went up as he sailed away toward a row of tall poplars, where, at what seemed the last minute, the left wing dropped sharply. He banked off to the left, turned in a graceful curve, and came flying back toward the grandstand. Those in the crowd who had brought field glasses had seen how he twisted the wings as he turned and rounded corners as naturally as though he were on a bicycle. Very near the point where he had started, he made another perfect turn to fly full circle once again, all at about 30 to 35 feet. Before coming down to a gentle landing within 50 feet from where he had taken off. In all, he was in the air not quite 2 minutes and covered a distance of 2 miles. The crowd was ecstatic, cheering, shouting, hardly able to believe what they had seen. As said in the Paris Herald, it was not the extent, but the nature of the flight, which was so startling. There were shouts of, "C'est l'homme qui a conquis l'air." This man has conquered the air. And il n'est pas bluffeur. He is not a bluffer. One of the French pilots present, Paul Zinn, who had been waiting since morning, told a reporter, "I would have waited 10 times as long to have seen what I've seen today." "We are children compared to the Wrights," said another pilot, René Gasnier. And Louis Blériot declared outright, "I consider that for us in France, and everywhere, a new era in mechanical flight has commenced." Then, catching his breath, Blériot said he was not yet sufficiently calm to express all that he felt, except to say, "C'est merveilleux." Spectators waving hats and arms raced onto the field, everyone wanting to shake the hero's hand. Hart Berg, knowing how Wilbur felt about such things, did all he could to keep the men from kissing Wilbur on both cheeks. The enthusiasm, reported Le Figaro, was indescribable. Even Wilbur lost his customary composure, overwhelmed by the success and unbounded joy which his friends Hart O. Berg and Leon Bollée shared. Then, very calmly, his face beaming with a smile, he put his hands in his pockets and walked off whistling. That night, while the normally sleepy town of Le Mans celebrated, the hero retired early to his shed. That summer Saturday in Le Mans, France, not quite 8 years into the new 20th century, one American pioneer had at last presented to the world the miracle he and his brother had created on their own, and in less than 2 minutes demonstrated for all who were present, and to an extent no one yet had anywhere on earth, that a new age had begun. In less than 24 hours, it was headline news everywhere. Wright flew, Le Matin. Mr. Wilbur Wright makes his first flight. French experts amazed by its smoothness. Paris Herald. Marvelous performance. European skepticism dissipated. London Daily Mail. A triumph of aviation. École de Paris. Wright, by flight, proves his might. Chicago Tribune. Wright's airplane ascends like a bird. Dayton Journal. It was not merely a success, said Le Figaro, but a triumph, a decisive victory for aviation, the news of which will revolutionize scientific circles throughout the world. The mystery, which seemed inextricable and inexplicable, is now cleared away, declared Le Matin. Wright flew with an ease and facility such that one cannot doubt those enigmatic experiments that took place in America, no more than one can doubt that this man is capable of remaining an hour in the air. It is the most extraordinary vision of a flying machine that we have seen. Wilbur Wright, wrote Joseph Brandreth of the London Daily Mail, had made the most marvelous aeroplane flight ever witnessed on this side of the Atlantic. The length of the flight was not what mattered, but that he had complete control and, by all signs, could have stayed in the air almost indefinitely. Leaders of French aviation joined in the chorus of acclaim. Not one of the former detractors of the Wrights dare question today the previous experiments of the men who were truly the first to fly, announced the greatly respected publication L'Aérophile. Even the stridently skeptical Ernest Archdeacon, who had run on with so many negative comments while waiting in the grandstand, stepped forth at once to say he had been wrong. For a long time, for too long a time, the Wright brothers have been accused in Europe of bluff. They are today hallowed in France, and I feel an intense pleasure in counting myself among the first to make amends for the flagrant injustice. An exuberant Hart Berg wanted Wilbur to keep flying the next day, but Wilbur would have no part of it. As was explained in the French press, today, because it is Sunday, Monsieur Wright, a good American, would not think of breaking the Sabbath. The crowd that came to Unadier would have to be content with looking at a closed hangar. On Monday, August 10, when the demonstrations resumed, more than 2,000 people came to watch, including a number of Americans this time. Nearby inns and cafes were reaping a harvest of money. Those who had made the effort to attend were to be even more dazzled by what they saw than those who had been there 2 days before. It was another perfect summer day, but as the hours passed, with nothing happening, the heat became intense. Still, no one left. Sitting among the crowd was a French army captain in uniform carrying a camera. Previously told he was to take no photographs, he had given his word he would not. But shortly afterward, he began using the camera and was spotted by Wilbur, who, ablaze with anger, climbed directly into the grandstand and demanded both the camera and the plates. At first, the captain hesitated, offering excuses, but as reported in the papers, Mr. Wright set his mouth firm, folded his arms, and waited. The captain handed over the camera and plates and left the field. Perhaps it was the heat, or the stress he was under, or a combination of both, that caused Wilbur to do what he did. Quite upset afterward, he said he was not in the habit of making trouble, but it had been too much for him when he saw the man deliberately break his word. Wilbur's performance that afternoon was surpassing. On one flight, heading too close to some trees, he had to turn sharply. As the correspondent for the Daily Mail reported, in a flight lasting 32 seconds, he took a complete turn within a radius of 30 yards and alighted with the ease of a bird in the midst of the field. It was the most magnificent turning movement that has ever been performed by an aviator. That evening, the light fading, Wilbur flew again, this time making two giant figure eights in front of the crowd in the grandstand and landing exactly at his point of departure. An aircraft flying a figure eight had never been seen in Europe before. Blériot had been so impressed by what he had seen on Saturday that he had returned again. Present also this time was the pioneer French aviator Léon Delagrange, who, after hearing of Wilbur's performance on Saturday, had halted his own demonstrations in Italy to hurry back. Both men were as amazed as anyone by Wilbur's figure eight. "Well, we are beaten. We just don't exist," Delagrange exclaimed. As a thrilled Léon Bollée declared, "Now all have seen for themselves." With the mounting popular excitement over the news from Le Mans came increasing curiosity about the man making the news. The Wright machine had been shown to be a reality, but what of the American flying it? Of what sort was he? Correspondents and others on the scene did their best to provide some clues, if not answers. In a memorable portrait written for the Daily Mail, Joseph Brandreth seemed a touch uncertain whether he liked Wilbur. Nor, it is known from a letter he wrote to Catherine, did Wilbur much like him. Brandreth was struck most by how greatly Wilbur resembled a bird, an odd bird. The head, especially, suggested that of a bird, and the features, dominated by a long, prominent nose that heightened the bird-like effect, were long and bony. From their first meeting, Brandreth wrote, he had judged Wilbur Wright to be a fanatic. A writer for Le Figaro, Franz Richel, fascinated with the flecks of gold in Wilbur's eyes, came to much the same conclusion. The flecks of gold, wrote Richel, ignite a passionate flame, because Wilbur Wright is a zealot. He and his brother made the conquest of the sky their existence. They needed this ambition and profound, almost religious faith in order to deliberately accept their exile to the country of the dunes, far away from all. Wilbur is phlegmatic, but only in appearance. He is driven by a will of iron which animates him and drives him in his work. Without wanting to diminish the value of French aviators, Richel wrote that while Wilbur Wright was flying, they were only beginning to flutter about. Léon Delagrange, who before becoming an aviator had been a sculptor and painter, could not help puzzling over what went on behind Wilbur's mask-like countenance, and, being French, found it hard to comprehend, or warm to, someone who seemed so devoid of the elemental human emotions and desires. Even if this man sometimes deigns to smile, one can say with certainty that he has never known the douceur, sweetness, of tears. Has he a heart? Has he loved? Has he suffered? An enigma, a mystery. That said, Delagrange openly declared in the article he wrote for L'Illustration, Wilbur Wright is the best example of strength of character that I have ever seen. In spite of the sarcastic remarks and the mockery, in spite of the traps set up from everywhere all these years, he has not faltered. He is sure of himself, of his genius, and he kept his secret. He had the desire to participate today to prove to the world he had not lied. To François Perret, who had seen more of Wilbur than had others, and knew more, he was un timide, shy, a simple man, but also a man of genius who could work alongside the men of the Bolle factory just as he could work entirely alone, who could cook his own meals, and do whatever else was necessary under most any conditions, and quiet by nature. He went his way, always in his own way, never showing off, never, ever playing to the crowd. The impatience of 100,000 persons would not accelerate the rhythm of his stride. Further, Perret, unlike others, had discovered how exceptionally cultured Wilbur was, how in rare moments of relaxation he talked with authority of literature, art, history, music, science, architecture, or painting. To Perret, the devotion of this preacher's son to his calling was very like that of a gifted man dedicating his life to a religious mission. At the close of one long day at Le Mans, Perret had caught Wilbur gazing off into the distance, as if in a daydream. It reminded him, Perret wrote, of those monks in Asia Minor, lost in monasteries perched on inaccessible mountain peaks. What was he thinking of this evening, while the sun was dying in the apricot sky? On Thursday, August 13, Wilbur flew again, this time circling the field several times. It was his longest flight yet at Le Mans and before the biggest crowd, which cheered every round he made. So loud was the cheering that he flew to nearly 100 feet in the air, in part to lessen the distracting effect of the noise. He was trying to master the use of the control levers, and after one turn he found himself flying too low. To compensate, he made a blunder, as he would later explain to Orville. He pushed the left lever forward instead of back, and the left wing hit the ground. It was, he acknowledged, a pretty bad smash-up. He himself, however, had been uninjured. The admiration of the crowd diminished not at all. Those who knew the most about the art of flying were more impressed than ever. One French aircraft designer told a reporter for the New York Herald, "Mr. Wright is as superb in his accidents as he is in his flights." Wilbur could scarcely believe the change that had come over nearly everyone, the press, the public, the French aviators and aircraft builders. "All question as to who originated the flying machine has disappeared," he wrote Catherine. The popular furor could be irksome at times, to be sure. "I could not even take a bath without having 100 or 2 people peeking at me. Fortunately, everyone seems to be filled with a spirit of friendliness." A new song, "Il Vole," "He Flies," had become a popular hit. Also, much to Wilbur's liking, a stray dog had been added to his camp life by Hart Berg and christened Flyer. Much of the feeling back in Dayton was expressed in a wholehearted hometown tribute published in the Dayton Herald. "All were extremely proud of the brothers," declared the paper, "and not because that was the fashion of the moment, but because of their grit, because of their persistence, because of their loyalty to conviction, because of their indefatigable industry, because of their hopefulness, and above all, because of their sterling American quality of compelling success." A letter from Catherine assured Wilbur that the whole family was thrilled by the news from Le Mans, but that thrilled and proud as they were, their minds were greatly on edge over young Milton, Lauren's 15-year-old son, who had been stricken by typhoid fever and was in a struggle for his life. "How many, many times have we wished for Julem since Milton has been sick," she wrote. "Of course we were delighted over your flight, but we can't half enjoy anything now. If we weren't so poor, we'd cable congratulations. A week later, she could happily report that Milton was out of danger, and the Dayton papers were still going wild over the news from Le Mans. They were even proposing a big welcome home. With the demonstrations at a standstill momentarily until repairs were made, Wilbur had more time to appreciate those around him and enjoy the attention they were giving him. A local manufacturer of canned goods was providing all kinds of the finest sardines, anchovies, asparagus, so forth and so forth, you ever saw, he reported to his father. The people of Le Mans are exceedingly friendly and proud of the fame it, the experiments, is giving their town. I'm in receipt of bouquets, baskets of fruit, and so forth, almost without number. The men down at Bollet's shop have taken up a collection to buy me a testimonial of their appreciation. They say that I, too, am a workman. When the French army offered Wilbur a larger field for his demonstrations, he accepted, and so the flyer, its damages fully repaired, was moved 7 miles east to Camp Dovor. The new grounds are much larger and much safer than the old, he reported home. I can go 4 miles in a straight line without crossing anything worse than bushes. He resumed flying at Dovor on August 21, and the crowds arriving by special trains grew larger by the day, the excitement almost beyond comprehension. Though Camp Dovor was lost in the middle of the woods, as said, and less convenient to town than the race course of Unandière, the crowds came in numbers greater than ever. They flocked for miles, their curiosity too strong, reported Le Figaro, only to find that Wilbur, for some reason or other, was not flying that day. Never mind, was the response. We'll come back. It was almost as though the less he flew, the greater the curiosity of the crowd. The public is of an untiring and admirable patience. It waits for hours on end to see nothing but the famous launching pylon. When it is late and they know that Wright won't fly, these good people gather at the foot of the pylon, measure it with their eyes, touch it, because they know what they will have to do tomorrow. Come back. Brother Orville was much on Wilbur's mind, for by then Orville had gone to Washington to begin preparing for the flights he was to make at Fort Myer, Virginia. Earlier in midsummer, as Wilbur had been about to proceed with his demonstrations for the French, he had received a letter from his father urging him to avoid all unnecessary personal risk. Now Wilbur sent off much the same kind of warning to Orville, as older brother, but also as one who had now experienced a number of turns on stage before enormous crowds and an ever-eager, ever-demanding press. I tell them plainly that I intend for the present to experiment only under the most favorable conditions. I advise you most earnestly to stick to comms till after you are sure of yourself. Don't go out even for all the officers of the government unless you would go equally if they were absent. Do not let yourself be forced into doing anything before you are ready. Be very cautious and proceed slowly in attempting flights in the middle of the day when wind gusts are frequent. Do not let people talk to you all day and all night. It will wear you out before you are ready for real business. Courtesy has limits. If necessary, appoint some hour in the daytime and refuse absolutely to receive visitors, even for a minute at other times. Do not receive anyone after 8 o'clock at night. Then, after some technical discussions about the rudder, he wrote again, I can only say, be extraordinarily cautious. On the evening of August 25 in Le Mans, a celebration banquet in Wilbur's honor took place at the Hôtel du Dauphin. This time, he was happy to join in the festivities. Part 3. Chapter 9. The Crash. He rode the air as deliberately as if he were passing over a solid macadam road. Nothing I have ever seen is comparable. Goodson Borglum. 1. With her young nephew Milton much improved in health, and her classes at the high school soon to resume, Catherine was feeling more herself. Orville was in Washington preparing for the demonstrations at Fort Myer, staying at the elegant Cosmos Club and meeting stacks of prominent people. And hardly a day passed without something in the papers about the continuing clamor over Wilbur in France. Both brothers wrote when they had time, but Catherine longed for more than just aviation talk. "Suppose you tell me about a few things when you write," she admonished Wilbur in one letter. "What do I care about the position of the trees on the practice ground? Hey, hey, Sturtians wants to hear all about the beautiful young ladies and the flowers and champagne." Wilbur would go only so far as to tell her that Mrs. Berg was a very smart and charming woman like yourself. Orville said he could hardly get any work done, so much time was taken up answering the 10,000 fool questions people asked me about the machine. A Washington Post reporter noted with amazement how Mr. Wright stood and talked and talked and talked to his questioners. Still, with it all, Orville was frank to tell Catherine, "I am meeting some very handsome young ladies." The trouble was, if he were to meet them again, he would have a hard time remembering their names. "I don't know when Pop has been in such good health," she was happy to report to Wilbur. "Now, if you and Orville don't do some wild things to get me crazy, I think I'll weather the thing through." Fort Myer occupied a stretch of high ground on the Virginia side of the Potomac River, just west of Arlington National Cemetery. With its neatly arranged, handsome red brick buildings, it looked not unlike an attractive college campus, and offered a panoramic view of Washington 5 miles in the distance. At the center was the parade ground, measuring approximately 1,000 by 700 feet, and there Orville was to perform his test flights. It was a space smaller even than what Wilbur had to work with at Les Unandières, but with it came an ample shed for a hangar, and a dozen army men ready to assist. To get there from the city, he traveled back and forth by streetcar. After several days of trouble with the motor, and with help from Charlie Taylor and Charlie Furness, both of whom had come from Dayton, he had all in order as scheduled. It would be the first full-scale public performance of a Wright plane in the United States, and the machine Orville was to take into the air had never been flown until now. Not until late in the afternoon of September 3rd was it wheeled into place. That Orville was extremely on edge was plainly evident. "For the first time since his arrival in this city," wrote a reporter for the New York Times, "Mr. Wright betrayed obvious signs of nervousness. The lines on his face seemed deeper than ever, and there was a furtiveness and an uneasiness of manner which was noticeable to everyone. He seemed to be making a tremendous effort to control himself. He could hardly hold still. One minute he would be up on a sawhorse examining the upper wing, the next down on his hands and knees helping adjust the starting mechanism. That man's nerves are pretty near the jumping-off place," another correspondent was heard to say. The crowd on hand was small. Washington had yet to catch on to what was happening at Fort Myer. At last, at about 6 o'clock, Orville climbed into his seat. The motor was started, and the big propellers were cutting the air at a frightful rate, when he called out, "Let her go." The weights of the catapult dropped, the plane shot down the rail, but then for 50 feet or more it skimmed barely above the grass before lifting into the air. Everyone was shouting. At the lower end of the drill field, Orville banked, turned, and started back, the white canvas of the double wing standing out sharply against the dark border of trees at the edge of Arlington Cemetery. The crowd broke into a frenzy of enthusiasm as the plane circled overhead at about 35 feet and headed away down the field again. Suddenly it veered off toward the wooden hangar, descended at an abrupt angle, and hit the ground. The crowd rushed forward to find Orville calmly brushing the dust from his clothes. "It shows I need a great deal of practice," he said. By his estimate, he had flown somewhat less than a mile at a speed of about 40 miles per hour. According to their contract with the Army, the brothers were to receive $25,000 if the flyer achieved 40 miles per hour in its speed test. The day after, Friday, September 4, Orville and the flyer remained in the air more than 4 minutes, circling the parade ground 5.5 times under perfect control, covering 3 miles with no mishap. Major George Squire, president of the board in charge of the test, thought the flight splendid. "The flyer seemed to respond perfectly to your every touch, and that landing was a marvel," he told Orville. Other officers were calling it the most wonderful exhibition they had ever seen. In the days that followed, Orville provided one sensational performance after another, breaking one world record after another. As never before, the two bicycle mechanics and their flying machines were causing simultaneous sensations on both sides of the Atlantic. They had become a transcontinental two-ring circus. Only now it was the younger, lesser-known of the two, whose turn had come to steal the show. Early the morning of Wednesday, September 9, with relatively few spectators present, Orville circled the Fort Myer parade ground 57 times, remaining in the air not quite an hour. When word reached Washington that he might fly again that afternoon, offices were closed, and 1,000 or more government officials, members of the cabinet, department heads, embassy personnel, members of Congress, came pouring across the Potomac by automobile and trolley to see for themselves. At 5:15, as the sun was disappearing below the Virginia horizon, wrote the Dayton Journal correspondent on the scene, "the latest invention of man to change the laws of nature rose grandly into space and sailed over the drill grounds. Higher and higher it rose, turned at a slight angle as the aviator brought it round the far side of the field, and raced along at increasing speed. Round after round the machine traveled on, cutting short turns, shooting along the stretch, and presented somewhat the appearance of an automobile racing about an imaginary course in the air." He had flown around the circle 55 times, and was in the air altogether 1 hour and 3 minutes, another new world record. At home in Dayton, the Herald called it the most marvelous feat in aviation yet recorded. The next day, September 10, against a stiff wind, Orville stayed in the air longer still by several minutes. Worried that Orville might be losing count of the number of times he had circled the field, Charlie Taylor climbed on top of the flyer shed with a pot of white paint and a brush, and began marking off the times on the tar paper roof in figures big enough for Orville to see. As the numbers 50 and 55 appeared, the excitement of the crowd became acute. Charlie began signaling with his arms. Not until after dusk, upon completing 57.5 circles, did Orville start back down to earth. Swooping in for a landing, the plane headed straight in the direction of the crowd, but then, sending up a cloud of dust as its skids hit the ground, came to a stop not more than 20 feet short of the crowd. One of those watching that day was the noted sculptor Goodson Borglum, who was later to carve the faces on Mount Rushmore. When he first saw Orville's plane sitting on the ground, he had not been particularly impressed. It looked to him like something any boy might build, not at all how he had imagined a flying machine. But then Orville had taken off. He could fly as he wished, move as he willed. He rode the air as deliberately as if he were passing over a solid macadam road. Nothing I have ever seen is comparable. There is no action of the wings, so you do not think of birds. It has life, power. And yet it was so simple, Borglum wrote, that one wondered why in the world human beings had not built one along.